right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We got a packed show for you today. One that's going to make me talk real fast all the time, okay? And at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking to the author of a play called Scraps. And it's a really, really, it's a really important play. And I really will be advising everybody, try and see it. It's really moving and it's really important. And beyond that, before that, we're going to be talking with attorney Damon Alamari, and he's the attorney for one of the people in the Freeway 9 case. And it's an interview about what's going on there, all the attempts, all the moves by the system to actually come down on these people as hard as possible, and why and what's behind it. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show two people, including one who has a damn phone on.
Whoops.
That's all right. I was just reminding myself, I have a phone on too. Anyway, Chantel.
Hi, Michael.
Hi. Good to have you back on the show. Were you on this before?
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is my third time now.
Third time. I thought it was once, actually, but okay. That's great. I'm glad to see you. All right, and Chantel is going to be here with us, and Coco Das from Refuse Fascism is going to be here. And Chantel, you're actually with Refuse Fascism, and you're with the
Revolution Club.
Yes, okay. And Coco, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, sure.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's been a long time since we talked to you, so that's let's change that in the future, okay? Anyway, let's jump into this. I'm going to start. Maybe what I'll do is I'll start first with letting people know that the Freeway 9 and the UCLA 5 are heroes facing criminal charges for blocking the 101 freeway in the fall of 2017 and for disrupting the fascist Steve Mnuchin at UCLA in the spring of 2018. And these actions, for which the defendants are facing years in jail and several thousand dollars in fines, were aimed at sounding the alarm against the Trump-Pence fascist regime, which, believe me, if you have been looking, if you're just breathing and walking past anything, a newspaper, a television, something, you got to know that this threat of fascism is not a joke. It's something that is very real, and you can see it more and more every day. So I'm going to open this up. Maybe what I'll do is I'll open it up first with Coco. Coco, let's talk about this. Let's talk about what was happening in general around this, and then we'll move in a couple minutes to talk about actually what's happening with the defendants.
Yeah, so, I mean, Chantel and Alex, who just were on trial, and their trial ended in a hung jury, which is actually a great victory. It denied the city of Los Angeles the conviction that they wanted for an act of meaningful protest when they blocked the 101 freeway twice in 2017. The fact that they're turning around so quickly to retry this case, and, you know, the way that they framed the case as something that was just a traffic violation, completely suppressing even facts of their own investigation and the political nature, and, you know, why Alex and Chantel and the others went out nonviolently risking life and limb to make a statement. They were the first advanced forces to sound the alarm against this fascist regime and to state that in the name of humanity, millions of us can get into the streets and in a sustained nonviolent protest movement actually drive out a regime that represents a catastrophe for humanity. And 2.5 years later, the need for this is even starker. I mean, as you said, all you have to do is be a living, breathing person in the society and see what's happening. But the city is actually going out of its way to suppress this kind of protest. And, you know, it's alarming that even in a liberal city, sanctuary city like Los Angeles, this is happening. But, you know, this is part of the fascist suppression of dissent and protest all over the country. And, you know, mainly, yes, Trump is the one who said that he'll pay the legal fees of people who beat up protesters. And, you know, he longs for the days when protesters were carried out on stretchers. But mainly this is going to be enforced on the local and state level. So these kinds of cases, if they result in a conviction, would make for a very bad political precedent for suppression of dissent in general. And when you have a regime that's running concentration camps at the border and, you know, throwing gasoline on the climate crisis and doing all the things that they're doing, the suppression of dissent is going to be very important. It's a key linchpin of consolidating their power. So it's really important that people have their backs. Alex and Chantel are heroes. And more people need to be like them.
All right. Chantel, let's talk with you a little bit about this, because you can talk about your feelings about all this, but also I want to move into, because we are limited in time, I also want to move into, it's right to sound the alarm against fascism. So let's jump into this a little bit.
We can't wait till 2020, and the Democrats don't have the answer for this.
It's very true that actually, you know, things are moving very, very quickly. If people have been watching even a little bit of television since Trump is going out, you know, just going out into the wilds and whipping up his support base, you can really see things are amping up very, very quickly, and it's a very dangerous situation. Now, let me ask again. Let's go back and Coco, tell me this. What, you know, you're looking at this and you're thinking, okay, what's the repercussions of this? I mean, this is a very serious thing. This is not just, you know, people might look at it and say, well, look, they're just saying that, you know, people should pay attention to traffic signs and stuff like that. But there's actually something much deeper here in terms of being able to stop what is actually it represents a really visual and really lonely, unfortunately, at this point, although there's some things developing up now. But there's actually a need for people to understand that what people did in standing up against this was extremely important, because this is actually what's needed, and there's not nearly enough of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are precious few forces that are actually engaging in the kind of resistance that's needed to stop this. Millions of people hate what's going on, but very few are stepping outside of the normal channels and actually acting in a way that's commensurate with the emergency that we're facing. So the repercussions of this is that they're trying to cut the legs out from under a potential protest movement that can grow, that can actually disrupt and create a political crisis for this regime. And that includes, you know, meaningful acts of civil disobedience, like blocking the 101 freeway. But, you know, who knows where that can end? So, you know, 35 states actually have either passed or proposed laws that are criminalizing protest or making it legal for vehicular assault on a protester if they say it was an accident. So it's very dangerous. And I don't think anybody can stand aside and say, okay, it's okay for people who are really stepping out there to be prosecuted. It has repercussions for everybody. And anyone who doesn't want to live in a fascist America has to take a stand on this. One of the things that we're posing to people is, it's not enough to hate this. You have to take a stand. You have to choose your side, or history's going to choose for you. And, you know, that means that all the millions of people who do hate this and all the listeners who do hate what's going on, it's time to step up. Because, you know, it's not going to be a good situation for anybody and they're not going to stop trying. These prosecutors are not going to stop trying. And we've got more trials coming up in September. So, you know, it's going to be a fight, and more people need to get into it.
Absolutely. Now, we're going to have to begin to wrap this up, but I want to ask you, Chantel, tell us, do you have anything you want to add to this?
Yeah. I wasn't always this politically active. I knew that Trump was a danger to, one, at first the immigrants, and now he's a danger to women. He's a danger to everybody. He's a danger to this planet. You know, and he has his finger on the nuclear trigger. So it's just really important to understand how dangerous one more day of Trump in office is. And I understood that, and I reacted to the call that Refuse Fascism put out and got on the freeway not once but twice, trying to show how important it is that we step outside the normal chains of protest as usual, and relying on the system that brought Trump into power in the first place, relying on the system to stop him, because it's not happening. The Democrats are still teasing us with impeachment and reports, and it's just not going to happen. So I really encourage more people to be brave and step outside of these normal chains and demand, you know, that this regime must go.
All right. Thank you both very much. I really appreciated talking with you. And we'll have you back on the show real soon, because we were running out of time now. But I do want to have you back. So, Coco, one last word from you real quick.
Everyone go to refusefascism.org and follow the case and follow the whole movement to drive out Trump and Pence. with sustained nonviolent protest, refusefascism.org.
You know, if you're agonizing about what needs to be done, you need to watch this film of a speech by Bob Avakian. Trump Pence regime must go. A better world is possible.
All right. I want to thank both of you for joining us today. Okay.
Thank you,
Michael.
Sure. All right. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
We came to the U.S. because there were people who wanted to hurt us.
I'm hungry here at Clint all the time. I'm so hungry that I've woken up in the middle of the night with hunger. I'm too scared to ask the officials for any more food.
There isn't water or soap to wash our hands after we use the bathroom. We have to ask for toilet paper if we want any.
My sister and I hold a blanket up for one another so no one can see us go to the bathroom.
I am 5 years old. I am from Honduras.
I am seven years old.
I am from El Salvador.
We came to the U.S. because there were people who wanted to hurt us.
I'm hungry here at Clint all the time. I'm so hungry that I've woken up in the middle of the night with hunger. I'm too scared to ask the officials for any more food.
There isn't water or soap to wash our hands after we use the bathroom. We have to ask for toilet paper if we want any.
My sister and I hold a blanket up for one another so no one can see us go to the bathroom.
I am 5 years old. I am from Honduras.
I am seven years old.
I am from El Salvador.
Asian separated me from my dad. I have not seen my father again.
I was wet when I got here and was placed in the cage without being given dry clothes.
It is so cold. I was shaking so hard.
I'm the third teenage girl who has tried to take care of this little 2-year-old boy. I feed him and give him water.
I also take care of another little kid. She calls me Mama. She is 6 years old.
There is no room to move without stepping over the others. We were not given a mat to sleep on, so we had to sleep on the cold concrete floor. The lights are on all the time.
We cannot sleep because every 15 to 20 minutes, the guards are yelling something. Get up!
We spent all day and every day inside of that room.
There are no activities, only crying.
During the 2 weeks we've been here, they have let us outside about 5 times for 20 minutes.
I would like to get some fresh air.
I've been here without bathing for 21 days.
Once, I needed clean clothes for my baby because she threw up. But when I asked for them, I was told they didn't have any available. She is still in the same dirty clothes. I have not asked for anything since then.
About 3 days ago, I got a fever. They moved me to a flu cell. There is no one to take care of you there. They just give you pills twice a day.
My skin is itchy and red, and my nose is stuffed up. It's so ugly to be locked up all the time.
I miss my mother who lives in Delaware. I don't know why I am still here.
I don't want to go back to my country. Sometimes, when we ask, we are told we will be in here for months.
Asians separated me from my dad. I have not seen my father again.
I was wet when I got here and was placed in the cage without being given dry clothes.
It is so cold. I was shaking so hard.
I'm the third teenage girl who has tried to take care of this little 2-year-old boy. I feed him and give him water.
I also take care of another little kid. She calls me Mama. She is 6 years old.
There is no room to move without stepping over the others. We were not given a mat to sleep on, so we had to sleep on the cold concrete floor. The lights are on all the time.
We cannot sleep because every 15 to 20 minutes, the guards are yelling something. Get up!
We spend all day and every day inside of that room.
There are no activities, only crying.
During the 2 weeks we've been here, they have let us outside about 5 times for 20 minutes.
I would like to get some fresh air.
I've been here without bathing for 21 days.
Once, I needed clean clothes for my baby because she threw up. But when I asked for them, I was told they didn't have any available. She is still in the same dirty clothes. I have not asked for anything since then.
About 3 days ago, I got a fever. They moved me to a flu cell. There is no one to take care of you there. They just give you pills twice a day.
My skin is itchy and red, and my nose is stuffed up. It's so ugly to be locked up all the time.
I miss my mother who lives in Delaware. I don't know why I am still here.
I don't want to go back to my country.
Sometimes when we ask, we are told we will be in here for months.
All right, as we mentioned earlier, the Freeway 9 and the UCLA 5 are heroes facing criminal charges for blocking the 101 freeway in the fall of 2017 and for disrupting the fascist Steve Mnuchin at UCLA in the spring of 2018. These actions, for which the defendants are facing years in jail and several thousand dollars in fines, were aimed at sounding the alarm against the Trump-Pence fascist regime, responding to a call from Refuse Fascism for a movement of millions to drive this regime from power through mass, sustained, nonviolent protest in the streets. Damon Alamari is the attorney for one of the Freeway Nine, who are currently going back on trial for standing up against fascism. Damon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I thought it was really important, and I really wanted to get into a conversation with you about the case, but also what you can notice about how that plays out in a bigger scale, too, to a degree. So let me start with this first question. Now, you got involved in this case in a unique and important way. How did you hear about it, and what made you want to take it up?
Synopsis of the case. In effect, the LA city attorney is charging a number of individuals with a few misdemeanor penal code and vehicle code violations, particularly obstruction of highway, failure to disperse from an allegedly unlawful assembly, I should say, failure to comply with a lawful order of a peace officer. So, factual breakdown, a number of protesters entered the freeway, the 101 freeway, I should say, and demonstrated against Donald Trump and the fascistic nature of his administration and policies. Those protesters, who are a part of a broader movement called Refuse Fascism, were arrested more or less immediately after entering the freeway. They did this twice, once in September of 2017 and the second time in November of 2017. They were immediately arrested upon entering the freeway. They were taken into custody about a year passed after the incidents occurred, and they were ultimately charged with the misdemeanor and penal code and vehicle code violations. I step into all of this in a unique way, that's correct. I was in court in the downtown LA Metropolitan Courthouse handling my daily affairs in court and what have you, and I happened to see a number of demonstrators in front of the courthouse wearing Refuse Fascism t-shirts and holding banners decrying the atrocities and crimes, in essence, being committed by the Trump administration and the U.S. government generally. And I inquired, I was curious, and they told me that the city attorney's office was charging a number of Refuse Fascism's members with these misdemeanor violations. And I felt compelled to provide assistance in the best way that I knew and know how to, and that is through my professional capacity. I offered my assistance. I offered to represent at least one of the protesters pro bono, that is, free of charge. I felt indignant over the fact that these individuals were, first and foremost, they were demonstrating on behalf of a good, decent cause. And I will say this unequivocally. I'd say that at least half of this country agrees with the essence of what they did. People are opposed to Donald Trump because people can see that what he's doing and what he represents is disturbing, to say the least. So what they did was decent. Second of all, I saw the city attorney's prosecution of these protesters, and I still see it, as a form of suppression, repression, suppression, control. So these individuals who protested in a nonviolent manner are now being persecuted for that. That, to me, is a form of suppression of a particular mode of thinking and a particular way of expressing one's political ideology and sentiments. So basically, I felt that this was an indication of a broader policy on the part of the city attorney's office specifically, and perhaps even the government as a whole, against protesters and those who are concerned about the very serious issues and problems that confront the average people of this country. And of course, I'm a trial lawyer. I believe in the right to a trial, a fair trial. I believe in the right to due process, etc. And I basically materialized those ideas through representation of these individuals. So that's basically all of that in a nutshell.
There was a certain approach that you had to this, which I thought was really important. You never gave an inch. The prosecution was claiming that this was simply a traffic case. Just admit it. They were out there. They were blocking the highway. They were causing people to be late for work and all this other stuff. They were disobeying our orders to get off the street, to get out of the highway. They were essentially saying no politics here. And you took that on full force. How did that get manifested during the trial, and how did you take it on?
First and foremost, I'm of the belief that the law is, in essence, a political mechanism. So in a very broad sense, every legal act is a political act. And every trial entails some sort of political implication. However, having said that, this trial, of course, is patently political, politically charged, to say the least. For the prosecution to attempt to separate the two in some sort of a mechanical and arbitrary way, first of all, that's impossible. It's impossible by the very nature of the act. These people were protesting Donald Trump. The banners contained anti-Trump messages. They were chanting against Trump. This is a political act, and there's no way to suppress that reality from the jury. So, first and foremost, it was impossible for the prosecution to separate the politics from all of this. Now, I do think that it was absolutely necessary to inform and educate the jury of the political motives of the protesters for a number of reasons. First, I know that the jurors or the prospective jurors by and large would have sympathized with the cause of these protesters, because by and large people in Los Angeles don't like Donald Trump. They consider him to be a racist, to be a fascist, to be a sign of bad things to come if he's not halted now. So that was one reason for presenting the political essence of the act. Another reason is I wanted to show to the jury that my client in particular, well, I was representing one of the two individuals that was tried, was acting in good faith, to use a legal term. He was acting not in a flippant or delinquent or consciously sort of flippant or delinquent way. He was acting nobly. He was acting decently, respectably, honorably. And I did say that throughout my closing argument. This is an honorable person. This is a person we should respect very highly, because he did something that many of us would have liked to do, but because of the constraints of our lives, we're unable to do what he did. So the trial in itself was political. Jurors would have and did sympathize with the cause, and it was necessary to explain the motives of the protesters. Also, I am a student of radical, I guess, trial lawyers of the 60s and the 70s. When I became a lawyer right out of law school, I didn't quite know what I was going to do, and I started reading literature by Kunstler, Jerry Spence, Tony Sara, Charles Gary, Johnny Cochran, F. Lee Bailey, guys like that. They're icons. I mean, I wasn't around then, but in reading about them, I mean, they were on the cover of New York Times, on Newsweek, Time Magazine, because of the causes that they represented and the way that they represented those causes. They were larger than life characters. They knew how to appeal to the average person in the course of a jury trial. And I remember listening to an interview with Charles Gary, who was famous for having represented Huey Newton and other members of the Black Panther Party in the 60s and the 70s. He said that his goal in representing them throughout the trials in which he represented them was to educate the jury about what they were aiming toward, to educate the jury, to let the jury know that the media, the government, has depicted these individuals as domestic terrorists, as it were. But actually, they are fighting a noble struggle. And he said it's absolutely necessary to do that in a trial, in a political trial, to educate the jury as to the motives of the defendants. And I learned from that, and I employed that strategy here.
That is one of the things that really struck me, is that you had to constantly keep coming back to that, too, in a certain sense, because it's inherently political. But at the same time, the system was actually pushing the fact that it's not political. They just violated traffic laws, you know, and yet they were willing to go through all this attempt to get them on trial, get them into jail, and at the same time say it's just a traffic offense. And there's this whole way that they tried to enforce rules that were just not true, but they then also went outside the courtroom. They tried to enforce rules that not only dictated that political discussion wasn't going to be tolerated outside of the courtroom in the hallways, but also outside, even outside of the courtroom building, which I think is, to me, it seemed fairly unique being done.
Right. With respect to the uniqueness of it, I can't speak on that because I don't know what the unwritten policy of a city attorney's office with respect to these sort of political trials. Perhaps in every political trial, they make the same requests of the court. Perhaps in the 60s and 70s, district attorneys and city attorneys and U.S. attorneys were lodging the same motions. I imagine so. So coming into this, I wasn't surprised at all that the city attorney moved in such a way. I expected it, but I was somewhat happy in a sense that the city attorney did so, because to me, it indicates the city attorney's fear of the momentum, of the general spirit of all of this. If the city attorney was not afraid of that, was not afraid of the jurors' potential susceptibility to the messages that were displayed outside the courtroom, then the city attorney would have never made a fuss about it. That indicates to me the potency of it. I was somewhat happy that the city attorney moved in such a way, and I was happy as well that the judge was, as far as judges go, he was fair, and he more or less shut the city attorney down with respect to the request to suppress free speech.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. And today we are talking with Damon Alamari about the case of the Freeway 9. Yeah, I think it's really important what you were just saying. I was looking at some of the stuff that I was thinking about earlier in preparing for this. And one of the things that really struck me is exactly what you're saying. You know, it's like one thing, the system went after the politics of the thing by saying that, look, there's no place for politics in this courtroom. You know, there's no place for politics in this case. What they were saying is like, when every time you try to bring it into it, every time you try to come back to the fact and say, no, actually politics are at the heart of it, they would make some move that would say, no, it's not doing that. And they really did want to gut the politics out of the case. And they even helped prove that point themselves in a way that actually tried to remove politics. And they claimed that in itself was essential to their case. And actually, I think you would agree that the politics of the case actually were essential. They were essential to the defendants in terms of actually getting across what was happening and why they were there.
Correct. The politics, it was essential to the case. It's inextricable, entirely inextricable. It doesn't matter what motions the prosecution would have lodged or will lodge in the future, because other protesters will face trial on this. There's no way that the politics is going to be somehow plucked from all of this. It's impossible. It's impossible, and again, it speaks to the fear of the city attorney. And I think it's something to be proud of, the fact that the city attorney is so afraid, and it's something that the city attorney, quite frankly, should be embarrassed of. The city attorney is aware that the politics of all this somehow jives with the general sentiments of the public. And the city attorney, because the city attorney is aware of that, wants to somehow mechanically and arbitrarily pull out the politics from this. That's shameful, to be quite honest.
To me, it seems like that's exactly the point. And it gets into this next question I wanted to ask, because in terms of the politics being essential to the case. The attorneys, the city's attorneys, all of them could say whatever they wanted about, no, it's not the politics. It's just stepping over the line, literally, in terms of getting in the way of traffic. And that's not the case at all. They did that, but at the same time, they did that openly and for a very strongly expressed reason. And I wanted to ask you this. Those politics, while the city's saying that this should not be entering into the case at all, basically saying these politics are beyond the scope of what should be discussed in this courtroom, at the same time, one of the most outrageous manifestations of politics enforced by the prosecution is the fact that they prevented the jury from even hearing about the outrageous attacks of a police spy in trying to set people up in relation to this whole thing.
Yes, again, that speaks to the fear of the city attorney. The city attorney was very aware that any discussion of an informant, of a spy, would incite the passions of the jurors. The jurors would feel angry, perhaps, suspicious, wary of the motives of law enforcement, of the motives of the city attorney, of the motives of the government generally in the city. If that were to come in, you know, that would be, to a certain extent, it would be harmful to the city attorney's case. Now, I would have loved to have that information brought in at trial, but there are certain legal parameters in which we operate as attorneys, and we follow the law. But we use the law to vindicate our clients, at least those of us who are concerned about vindicating our clients. So it's a mechanism that we employ the law to do what we can to vindicate our causes and our clients.
Let's talk about the particular character of the attack on your client, Alex.
The city attorney attempted to paint my client in particular as someone who, to say the least, was not concerned about the convenience, well-being, safety of the public generally. So the argument the city attorney made was that my client was, in a sense, selfish in that he blocked the freeway, and as a result of that, he could have caused all kinds of disarray, all kinds of harm. So the city attorney had to prove that my client acted maliciously in blocking the freeway. So, as such, the city attorney argued that he intended to bother, to annoy, to injure, to harass, etc., etc. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing. He did what he did out of a great and deep concern for humanity as a whole, as well as those individuals who were on the freeway that day. Even those individuals who may have been unhappy with the fact that they were delayed for a few minutes in getting to work, whether they knew it or not, he acted out of concern for them because he was acting out of concern for humanity as a whole.
Now, that was something that you very fiercely kept insisting on. I mean, it's sort of like the city attorneys would be saying, no, you can't talk about this. You know, you just answer the question. We'd ask you a simple question. And Alex would talk about why he was there, what he was doing, what he expected to happen, all this other stuff. But you actually were able to basically clear a pathway for him to be able to do that. I thought it was extremely important.
Yes, it was absolutely necessary. Without going too much into, you know, the strategy behind it, I will say that I wanted the jury to hear from his own mouth his reasons for doing what he did. I could have argued all the way, but to hear it from him is another story. That's another story, and that, I think, was very strong.
Let's step back a minute and take an overview of what the system's trying to do in this trial. Now, you know, there's been the system's involvement in trying to carry out this trial, what they were actually trying to do. And you issued a call in the end of it when you were giving, I guess, your closing statements and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that actually your closing statement was perfect in terms of how you were actually presenting the case all along. And mm-hmm. It went right up against all the bull that the city attorneys were arguing about, mm-hmm. you know, the character of the case and all this other stuff, and mm-hmm. urging people to convict them because they simply broke the laws and we can't have people breaking the laws. Mm-hmm. I wanted you to talk about that because you talked about that in a different way. You actually issued a call for the court to do the right thing in making the decision, and you said that this is something that history will be the true measure of what's going on in this trial.
Correct.
And I thought it'd be important to talk about how you presented that, your case in the end.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the law, that was the issue that was presented to the jury from the outset. I mean, the city attorney is actually, in fact, the one who brought to the jury the issue of the law and what the law is. So the city attorney opened that can of worms. And so because that was the case, I was able to elaborate upon the essence of the law, the essence of justice, the essence of fairness, and The fact of the matter is, we are all aware that sometimes acts that may be legal down the line, history may judge as acts that were not moral, ethical, principled, etc. For instance, those who, and, you know, we hear this example quite often, those who joined the Nazis in Germany acted within the range of legality. Some did. What they did was entirely legal. But we judge them now negatively. We look at them and we say, that was shameful. That was wrong, to say the least. That was criminal, in fact. What they did was criminal, despite the fact that they may have been acting within the parameters of what was held to be the law in that time and place. So perhaps the city attorney may even cogently argue that the defendants broke the law, as it were. But the fact is, the jurors, and that's the beauty of a jury trial, the jurors are the law. And I pose that question to them, for them to really contemplate about the historical significance of the actions of the defendants, of my client in particular. Will what he did be lauded in the future, or will it be frowned upon? I'm of the opinion that it'll be lauded. It'll be lauded. It'll be applauded. It'll be celebrated. Much like the acts of people like Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass. List goes on. I'm speaking strictly in terms of American political activists, but I mean, people like that existed and exist all over the world. The historical significance of the trial and trials such as these is something that needed and needs to be presented to jurors.
Where to now? What you were saying was extremely important, and I've often talked to people about these people who, you know, there were the people who went with the Nazis, and the people, there were the people who kept their eyes shut and just moved along and slowly, even in some places, would, you know, people would be taken from their homes and their homes would be left empty, and then people who thought, everybody thought they were fine, upstanding citizens,
right,
just paid attention to what was being said and said, oh my God, I walked into a free house, and ended up taking over the houses where people had been, you know, driven from.
Right.
And I think that's sort of, that's one thing that you were pointing to and pointing against, you know, in terms
right.
of this is, we cannot allow this to
exactly.
go on. And I was just thinking about in terms of where to now in relation to where does this go? Because there's a new trial that the prosecution has insisted upon and the judge agreed to. Where does this take things? And then what should people be thinking about and doing in relation to that, in your opinion?
Well, I think that the trial itself and the vigor with which the city attorney, the prosecution has been going after the defendants in these cases indicates broader spirit or policy on the part of the state government. Whether Donald Trump is in power or not, of course, Donald Trump is a reflection of the sort of barbarism of the system, the increasingly heightened barbarism of the state in this country in particular, in the world generally. I think that the vigor with which the prosecution has been going after these defendants indicates that there is a push to suppress the movement of people, the broad movements of people against these injustices. Right now, we're seeing these movements in their sort of nascent, early forms. But eventually, down the line, I imagine that thousands, millions, much like what we saw in the 60s and in the early 20th century, will get together and will protest and will organize and what have you against the crimes of the system. And more, in direct correlation with that, we will see increased persecution, organized governmental persecution. And that's precisely the fascism that the defendants and my client are decrying. So where now? We'll continue to be at the forefront of fighting against that. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, one other question is, so where do things stand legally now in relation to the case?
The case resulted in a mistrial. The jurors deadlocked. The jurors could not reach a verdict. Most of the time, this is a reflection of the sort of aggression with which the prosecution is going after the defendants. Most of the time, the prosecutors dismiss cases after a mistrial, such as this one. I mean, at the end of the trial, 9 of the jurors voted not guilty with respect to my client, 3 voted guilty. So most of the time in that scenario, the case is dismissed. The prosecution is able to see that a retrial would not result in a conviction and would just be a waste of resources and a waste of everybody's time. But here we are again, and we're going to retry the matter. And the prosecution is, the city attorney is ready, willing, and enthusiastic, in fact, about trying this matter. But we'll retry it, and I am very, very, very confident that the prosecution will be unable to secure a conviction of these defendants.
All right, Damon Almari, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, I saw a play a little while ago at the Matrix Theater called Scraps. And it was something that had me thinking for quite some time. And I sat there and I was thinking while I was watching it, and I was just mesmerized by what was going on stage. And I thought, I really need to have the person that's responsible for this come onto the show. And so I'm really happy to welcome to the show Geraldine Inoua.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
This play captures something very powerful from the very beginning. It's something that people don't really see a whole lot. So first I want you to tell people, just give people a synopsis of what the play is about.
So Scraps is a play that, from a plot standpoint, takes place after the death of a young black man. Forrest Winthrop has been shot by a white police officer, and he was unarmed. It's sort of modeled after all the stories that we hear in this media. However, Scraps takes a left turn. And that's the story that the play introduces. But what the play actually does is it deconstructs the grief and the trauma of all the people that lived on after the young man was killed, after Forrest died. And so basically the play is an exploration into the aftermath of what happens after these violent acts are committed, and it basically deconstructs the white supremacy that led to it. And that's the first part of it. But it's also, its mission is to put this story about what happens after the aftermath of a police act into the context of Western narrative. And so essentially, it is also a deconstruction of black performance in theater. And so it's also a deconstruction of genre and the fact that where black suffering has been allowed to live in the canon. And it sort of subverts the literary limitations that used to exist on black people in story. And it explodes that with a surprise that I won't give away.
And it is quite a surprise, folks. So when you go to see this play, you're going to have a very heavy surprise at the end of it. One of the things that you watch when a play is winding down, and you're watching the intensity of the audience's engagement with it. And in this play, when that was happening, you're sitting there and you're thinking, okay, when this is over, there's going to be an eruption. And it was clear there was an eruption in the audience. People just like were on their feet immediately. You also talk about in the beginning of this, I mean, just so people know, when you were talking about what the play is about, this idea of, I read where you said you, in Ferguson, where you talked about the impact of what happened in Ferguson with Michael Brown. And, you know, that was something that I think really was a major step in people recognizing the particular oppression of black people in this country.
Yeah.
And to see that body laying there.
Right.
And just think about all the people that were impacted by that. To see, you know, his mother, his family, his right. friends. And the body was just left laying there. On the one hand, it said, you don't mean anything to the world. At the same time, it was something that really did mean something to people. People understood what it said about this society and the humanity of black people in this society. And I'll just say this, in your play, that actually seems to be, for the whole first act, that's the thing that's there all the time.
Yeah.
And then it unfolds for other people. In relation to that, I thought it was very heavy on it. So
yeah, absolutely. I think I'm really glad you noticed that. Thank you so much. I mean, one of the things that I think makes the first part of the play so evocative is that it really is this deconstruction that goes a whole other level that we've sort of been given access to with social media, because we feel like these tragedies are. We feel them realer now. Like it just feels like, because we have videos of the last moments that these people are alive, or sometimes we have the actual death on film, we have this much more visceral experience of the dehumanization of the black body. But in my play, I tried to basically take that, the spirit of that notion, and make it a ghost story, because that's what all of these are. I mean, if you look at these videos, and I try to like limit my viewing of that because I don't think it is okay to consume human trauma in that manner. It's kind of voyeuristic and it speaks to like the darkest parts of the human mind, you know, the idea that Schadenfreude, taking people's pleasure and people's pain and stuff like that. But I feel like by placing it in my play, like in literary form, like a ghost story, you can sort of see the weight that that body carries, because even without actually appearing in the play, Forrest Winthrop is the main character. And that's the thing that I've been doing. I basically took this like phenomenon that's been happening through the proliferation of social media and the rise of being able to watch these events in real time, or feeling like you are because you're seeing the performance of it on film. And I tried to translate that into literary form and to go even deeper and to see like what life would have been captured if the cameras had stayed longer. What life would have been captured if the camera was interested in interviewing people past the immediate aftermath. Because that's what Scraps is actually about. Scraps is a play that is not concerned in the immediate aftermath of police violence, because the immediate aftermath has been dissected and criticized and deconstructed by white publications, by black publications, by the family. That's the only part of the trauma that America has talked about. And the thing that matters to me most is what happens afterward, because as a person who's been through a lot of trauma myself, I have a very good understanding that even though traumatic events are what happens, like if you were to sit around and collect the number of hours that I've actually been abused and you stood that in relation to the amount of the impact that those hours had on my life, you would be astounded, because the actual death of Forrest Winthrop or the Michael Brown or the beating of Geraldine Anoa or the rape or whatever happened happens in a split second. But what actually changes your life is all of the moments afterwards, because when trauma hits, it breaks your brain, and what rebuilds in its aftermath is what I'm interested in.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, and we're talking with playwright Geraldine Anoa about her play, Scraps. That's really interesting in terms of this one thing of a lot of the first act of the play revolves around a stoop.
Yeah.
In Brooklyn, in Bed-Stuy, and it's like, there's a certain universality there that exists in terms of black people's lives, that things unfold in that kind of community that's set there. But you're looking there, and exactly what you're saying, you're, this presence of the dead person without being part of the play in a standard sense of it being a part of the play, you actually uncover something where the impact of what has been done to this individual, but then stepping back, and if you have any knowledge of what life is like for the vast majority of black people in this country, you have to recognize, one, the horror of understanding, but the beauty you brought to it, I thought was really important, that people got to see how incidents like this, how crimes like this actually impact people, but impact black people deeply. And not because it was their friend, but because there's a certain overall oppression that exists in the world. And one of the things I really found very, very important in your play is the presence of that stoop and what gets discussed there and the various people that come into that. They're all from the same neighborhood and they're all friends in the right. in the past and whatever, and even to a certain extent in the current time. But there's a lot of things going on that are, yes, there's the murder of this young man, but then there's also the murder in a bigger sense of what people are living through.
Right.
You know, so.
Absolutely. I really thank you. Your reading of the play is so exquisite, I have to say. It really is. It's really moving to me. And I'm with you 100% because while you were talking, I was thinking about how the play basically, I think one of the strengths of the first act is that if the play really goes wildly through these conversations on the stoop, this like very ordinary place where black life congregates in the play. And the stoop is sort of a metaphor because it's like, it's a place where everybody meets, but it doesn't move. And it's supposed to show you, or it's supposed to at least be one example of the momentum of these people's lives. The thing is, like, these people are stuck, you know? And I've sort of, like, been flashing, like, in my life and in my, like, thinking and in coming back to this play that, like, if you think of life as, like, a story and you think, what do people need in order to move forward? They need a want. They need to want something and they need obstacles that they can get through. And what Scrap shows you by putting it through this particular story of the danger and the mortality of Black life in America, it shows you that the story of Blackness in America is stuck because we want things and there are obstacles in our way that we cannot overcome. And that's what the stoop and all these conversations about the stoop is supposed to represent, that these people's desires for their life to continue is being unfortunately thwarted by a system that has decided that whatever wants they want, they can't overcome. And the story of the play really is that the death of their friend sent a message to every one of them that they could be next. And what you're watching is four people go through the like crisis of realizing that at any moment in America, because they're Black, because they're living in a society that considers that a detriment to their existence, there's a hit on them, there's a target on them. And so in a weird way, it's this like ghost story, but it's also like four people with like a hit on them reacting in real time, like, how do I advance my story and move the plot of my life when there's a hit on me?
See, that is so important for people to understand in terms of generally in society and in relation to Black people, and what has happened to Black people from the moment they were brought here to today, to us sitting in this room.
Yeah.
And see, that's one of the things that was, there was a beauty to your play, that there was that one scene, the way people were grappling with the horror of their friend being killed and the anger about one person about seeming to have gone away and come back, but has it all made for them and other people who are whatever, all the different dynamics that were on that stoop. But then you had something that was really beautiful. And it was something that reminded me of when I was a kid, because it's the music came in and the stoop and the dancing and the singing. But even there, it was something that was a concentration and it really meant something to people, and it helped them to seize their humanity.
Yeah.
And it was so important that it was there.
Yeah.
And then you know that it's a temporary thing too.
Yeah. So. Yeah. The music, I'm really just like moved by everything. No, really, I want to weep. It's so incredible to have my work seen in this way, because I worked for so long on this play and I feel like people are just starting to see it, you know? And it brings me deep sadness to say that I wrote something that is still relevant, because my play is about a tragedy on my country and my community and people like me that I thought would end, you know? But it's a horror that is going to continue on and on, and we just have to get through it. But that moment that you call out, where the music sort of unlocks this like communal aspect, it is supposed to be like, if you read into it with the history of Blackness in America, like music has been this like otherworldly element that could be summoned upon. It's the one moment in the play where everyone stops their story and they just join in and they become one. It's the moment in the play where everyone who in this play has absolutely no reason to ever dance or like sing or celebrate completely releases all of the things that they've been desiring and just gives in to this community like building moment. And it's just wonderful that you brought that up.
Yeah. As you're talking, I'm thinking exactly. Okay. We're running down on our time, but I wanted to ask a couple more questions. One is someone that had a very minor role in terms of appearance, but also was critical to this because it represents the other side of things. Damn, you did a good job with that cop.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the cop is, I don't think I'm giving anything away by saying, probably the least said the better.
Yeah, okay, yeah. All right. But it's just for people to know that the arrogant swagger was enough, because it captured a whole set of relations in this society.
Right.
And that arrogant swagger was really, it comes in the midst, including in the scene you were just talking about.
Yeah.
It's there.
Yeah. Yeah, the tension.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the thing is, what's interesting is in the play, up until that moment, whiteness has been the villain, but it has never truly appeared on stage. And so when you see whiteness enter the play, it changes it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially whiteness when it's a, let's just be honest, whiteness when it's a pig that right. comes in and does right. this, right?
Yeah.
So it's sort of, you know, yeah, and that's actually very important. I have one more question for you, which is, you've said that, and I think this is really important, that theater is truly the most brilliant way of weaponizing language. And I wanted to talk to you about that. I'll just say this, without saying another word about the second act, the response of people afterwards was so remarkable. I mean, I thought it was just really, people were out of their seats immediately. And it's a challenging end. You know, I'll leave it at that. It's a challenging end for a lot of people that were there. But I wanted to ask you this, because you've said that it's truly the most brilliant way theater of weaponizing language. And I wanted to ask about that, because I think there's something very, very important in that statement.
Absolutely. Weaponizing language. So, I mean, to me, the reason why I love theater the most is, as a person who's survived a lot of trauma and as a person who's interested in how do I prevent that from happening from other people, how can I help other people, as a trauma survivor, I've looked through the arsenal of America looking for a weapon against the world. And the only weapon that I can find that actually changes people in the way that I intend to, which is deeply and like through a place of empathy and compassion, is language. Because language is the entire way that we understand the world. Language is something everyone has in common. And so basically in this medium, I can take language and weaponize it in a way that it'll reach people that I will never be able to speak to. And so the brilliance of theater is that you can use language to build an entire world. Like, I don't have camera setups. I don't have all these other shortcuts that other mediums allow us to hone in. And so with language, I have to construct a story and get you in and keep you satiated for the duration of the play. And to me, that because it is one of the most challenging mediums, that is one of the most fascinating ways to, like, crack open what is essentially... Like, my plays, I look at them as, like, I don't know, they're like little soldiers. You know, there's, like, one soldier that is trying to fight the battle of Black performance in the narrative. And then I have another play that's, like, trying to fight the battle of queerness in a heteronormative world. And, I mean, I'm not a violent person, but I'm angry. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
On that note, it's a very important play. And, Geraldine, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.